Welcome back to the Motley Fool Radio Show, and now it's time to go to the Fool Phones for all your financial questions and comments. I welcome back, as usual, Diana Yoakam, our personal finance expert here at the Motley Fool. Diana, welcome.
Thank you, David.
Are you ready to answer some questions?
I think I am.
Will you shine the light of illumination
over
this segment of the show? Okay, wonderful. Let's go to the phones. The phone number 866-NPR-FOOL. Let's keep it in our home state of Virginia, Hampton, Virginia. Hi, Scott. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Very fine, and thank you for calling the show. What is your question?
My question relates to investing abroad. Jeremy Siegel, who is a well-known financial advisor at the Wharton School, says that most investors should have about a third of their money in international funds. And my question is this: is it better to invest abroad when the dollar as a currency is weak, like it is now, or when it's strong, like it hopefully will be in the future?
An excellent question, and it's a question, I assume, born out of your need to make a decision or desire to make a decision about your portfolio.
Exactly.
Okay. So I suspect, although Jeremy Siegel is always the one with the data, a past guest many times in this show, and a real historian of the market and its trends, I would suspect, based on my own rather superficial knowledge, but I have been playing the game for 20 years or so, that there is not a high degree of correlation between the level of the dollar and the stock market's performance. So when we talk a macro level, I am just going to guess out loud that I don't think that there's a big degree of difference, like stocks are up when the dollar's down or stocks are down when the dollar's weak. So that's my overall starting take. But Scott, my opinion is one thing. I have a surprise for you. We, in fact, have Professor Siegel on the line.
Yes.
Jeremy Siegel, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm very fine, thank you.
We have gotten a call from Scott in Hampton, Virginia, who has enjoyed your work over the years, has heard you talk about the importance of diversifying internationally. So Jeremy, expressed as succinctly as I can, is it better to invest internationally when the dollar is weak or when the dollar is strong?
Well, the real question, of course, is the dollar going to get weaker or is it going to get stronger? Because you really want to look at the future direction there. If you think the dollar is going to get much weaker, then investing internationally is going to be good, because obviously the value of your foreign holdings will tend to go up. If the dollar is going to get stronger, the reverse tends to be true. But Scott, I have looked at the data. Long run, it doesn't matter. Long run, all the changes in the dollar, the purchasing power, relative rates of inflation tend to wash out, and you want that diversification. So really, paying attention to dollar going up or down is more of a short-term investment strategy. And if you want to set your portfolio for the long run, you shouldn't be concerned about that.
And so at the end of the day, it sounds like I was trying to time the market, and as Lou Rukeyser used to say, that's never a good idea, and he was speaking domestically. So it sounds like it's not a good idea when you're speaking internationally either.
Yeah, absolutely. You got it absolutely right there. Really, trying to figure out where the Dow is going is just as hard as trying to figure out whether the Dow is going to be up or down tomorrow. And, that's not the way you want to go about with a long-term investment plan.
Well, I appreciate that. It's been a real pleasure getting advice from someone like yourself. And I also want to thank the Motley Fools for arranging this.
It's absolutely our pleasure, and we're very fortunate to have Jeremy Siegel on this show from time to time. And thank you very much, Scott.
Thank you.
And Jeremy, before we say goodbye to you, let me ask you one final question about international investing. I know certainly the easiest way to invest internationally is through mutual funds because they have diversified holdings. But I want to ask in particular about if I were to buy a stock. China today, such a popular thing. Everyone saw the Baidu.com IPO, biggest IPO in 5 years. Do you favor investing specifically in overseas companies, whether it's a Chinese company or, I don't know, Embraer is a very successful Brazilian airline company? Are these appropriate investments that can be made by individuals?
Most of the time, not. The problem is, again, they may be great companies, but all the excitement that gets generated bringing so many buyers in is apt to overprice the stock. I mean, we have the history there with the domestic companies and with Baidu, you know, following on top of Google. And yeah, that was that's been great so far. We'll have to see how those investors do later on. You know, my feeling is that, you know, if you go by with diversification, your safety margin just goes up dramatically. If you want to play with a couple stocks as a very small part of your portfolio, internationally and domestically, that's up to you. It can be fun. It's a great learning experience, but it's very hard to make that the bedrock of your investment strategy.
Great answer. Thank you. And unless our producers can get Brad Pitt on the line, I'm going to take advantage of having you here and ask my own question. Yes. Professor Siegel, I just bought a house here in Alexandria, Virginia. A lot of talk, of course, about a housing bubble. Can you reassure me that I did not, in fact, buy at the very tippy top of the housing market?
Well, you know, people ask me if there's a bubble, and I say, well, there's certainly no bubble, you know, given what interest rates are doing. If you were able to lock in a mortgage at these rates, I think you're going to do right. I think we are near the top of the big rise, which means it doesn't mean we're going to have a break. It doesn't mean the price of going down 30-40%, nothing like internet stocks, but it means that several years out we're going to get a flattening of prices. And as long as you can tolerate that, you're fine.
Okay.
It's those people who, you know, only buy because they have to have 10-15% appreciation all the time that I think are going to be in trouble.
So my dreams of flipping this condo, I should probably put those.
Yeah, I'd probably
in the back
stuff
pocket.
Those way a little bit and wait a while.
Okay, I think I can do that.
Well, there's never a bubble in shares of Professor Jeremy Siegel. Jeremy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here with you.
The phone number is 866-NPR-FOOL. Let's go to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Levi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, I'm a senior in at University of Central Oklahoma in Edmond, and I work for Starbucks, and recently I qualified to get enrolled in the 401k program, but, you know, being so young and so poor, I didn't know if that was such a good idea.
What was necessary for you to qualify to enter Starbucks' 401k?
Well, you have to be there for at least a year and maintain 20 hours a week.
Okay.
They're really good about taking care of their part-time employees.
So you've been an upstanding employee of some duration now. Would you describe yourself as doing a good job? What's your self-assessment of your performance at Starbucks, Levi?
Oh, I love it. And I work really hard there because it's one of the best companies you can work for in America.
So it sounds as if you would be willing to buy shares. Diana Yoakum, is this the right move for Levi at this point in his life?
I have a question. You're eligible to participate in the 401k. Have you looked at it? Does that mean you get discounts on Starbucks shares, or is investing in other choices that they have in the 401k plan?
Yeah, as far as I understand it, it includes discounted shares of Starbucks stock, but then they give you a list of choices of like low risk and medium risk and high risk and various other mutual funds.
Mm-hmm. Levi, here's what I have to say. You're a starving poor college student now, right?
Right.
Do you have credit card debt?
No, I don't.
Excellent. Jump all over that 401k.
Cool.
And why do I say that? Well, a 401k, it's a benefit. Like at any job, and it's really nice that you as a part-time employee are eligible for this. They're offering, it's like vacation days. It's a perk that you get for working there. And companies like Starbucks that are publicly held and traded on the market, they offer an additional benefit to employees who are interested in buying shares, which is you're able to buy discounted shares.
Yeah.
There.
Right.
Now, as far as the investment choices go, do you know if Starbucks matches your investment in the 401k in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah, up to 4%, and then it goes up after you stay for a certain period of time.
Fabulous. That's free money, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you can afford it to invest at least up to that 4% where you're getting the matching, do it.
Right.
And it doesn't matter. You don't have to stay at Starbucks forever, though. Sounds like you might want to work your way up the ranks. But what you can do is you can take that money, you can roll it over into a self-directed IRA if you ever do leave the company. So all of that investing is not for naught. It will continue to work in your favor once you do.
And the earlier you get started, the better. I wish that every college student in America would call the show and say, hey, should I start to invest in a 401k plan? Because the earlier you start, the more you compound that money over time, right? The more it doubles and triples as you age. And that's the real key here, Levi. Levi, what is your job at Starbucks?
I just got promoted to shift manager, actually.
Excellent.
I used to make coffee all the time, and now I get to tell other people to make coffee. So
now I am a frequent customer of Starbucks, and I'm wondering, what can I do better as your customer? How can I improve my game?
Oh, man, I'm sure you're great. I'm sure you're great.
I may well be good, but I'm interested in being better than I am.
Well, what do you drink?
Well, I usually just go in and go grande mocha, rather thoughtlessly. I have to admit, there's a wonderful word that describes me. This is actually a word in English literature, and it is oligophagus. I won't spell it here on the air, but what it means is I eat very few things. I'm not really particularly choosy or adventurous. And so I just go in and say grande mocha.
Well, that's great. Actually, you're our favorite kind of customer. Easy and to the point, and you know what you want. So that works for me.
Levi, what's the hardest drink to make?
Oh, man. Cappuccino by far, because everybody has a different idea of what you want for a cappuccino, and it's half milk, half foam.
Right.
So everybody wants a different amount of foam, and that's great. That's what makes it great. We can do it however you want it, you know?
I'm going to express my foam in percentage terms when I order next time.
Yeah, do it.
You know, it sounds like that would be appreciated.
Yeah.
Final question for you. Whenever I see the barista put the cup up on the transom there and people grab their cups, I wonder, out of every 500 cups or so, based on your experience, Levi, how many of those 500 are taken by somebody who was not, either had not paid for that or took the wrong drink, based on your experience?
Man, probably 20% of the time.
Wow.
It happens a lot. Yeah, it happens
a lot.
We make a lot of extra drinks just because it gets taken by the wrong person. It's fun.
You've heard it here on the Motley Fool Show.
Yeah,
we have discovered an inefficiency in Starbucks.
Well, the impressive thing, of course, is that the company is such a vital, robust, and profitable company, even with the likelihood of confusion that I see whenever I'm in a Starbucks.
Right.
It's a very well-run operation. Congratulations on where you are, Levi, and good luck to you, sir.
Thank you.
The phone number is 866-NPR-FOOL. Let's go to Flagstaff, Arizona. Joan is on the line. Joan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
A pleasure to have you. What's on your mind?
Well, we talk a lot on the show, and it's a great show, about people investing. And I'm at the point in my life where I have to start taking money out.
Ah, yes. You are, as we say, going through withdrawal.
That's right.
At this stage of your life.
You
okay.
Got it.
Okay.
I like to call it a spending spree.
I think that's fun. That's fun.
Well, Diane, I wish it was a choice. It has to do with serious illness and not ability to work any longer, and so I have to take that money out. And I don't know how to do that.
Okay, well, let's first of all say we're sorry to hear that. This is why you have saved, and certainly your savings are there to help you at this stage of your life. And congratulations for having them, Joan, because certainly a lot of us are hoping to get there in our lives and have that. Now, Diana, this is something that we're all, I hope, going to be doing, right? We're saving all this money in our 401ks to go through this process.
Right.
What's the first step? What's the next action for Joan?
Well, Joan, where is the money exactly?
Okay, it's in four mutual funds.
Mm-hmm. And are these in IRAs?
Yes.
Okay.
They're all IRAs.
Okay. And are you near retirement age?
I am almost 64.
Okay. Well, there are a couple general rules of thumb as you start to get near retirement age and are, you know, have left the workforce, whether it's, you know, for medical reasons or just because you have decided to retire. The first rule of thumb is take money out of the taxable accounts first. So this is money that is perhaps not in an IRA, because what you want to do is you want to leave the money that's in the accounts that have tax advantages to grow as long as possible.
Sure.
So that's your first rule of thumb. Second rule of thumb, if there are any accounts where you have over $500,000 in them, you probably want to start to draw that down, because at age 70 and a half, you're going to have to start taking money out of these accounts. Uncle Sam requires you to, he said.
And are you saying that's based on the amount in there?
Well, anything over $500,000, you're going to get a big tax bill.
Oh, I would love to have over $500,000.
Okay, so it sounds like Joan is saying that is not her problem
that
right now.
That is not your problem.
But you know what? It certainly is still a relevant consideration. It is at least a good rule of thumb to think about. So, okay, so next one, Dana.
Well, there aren't too many rules after that, except to really look at what the investments are, what the tax consequences are, and how much money you need.
Okay. I am already receiving Social Security.
Okay.
And it gives me about half of the money that I need.
Mm-hmm.
And in my four mutual funds, I have a little over $100,000. And I need to take it out probably about $1,000 a month to allow me to pay my regular expenses.
Okay, good. You've done a lot of the homework already. You know what it takes to live on every month. What you need to do is to protect that money you know you're going to need in the next 5 years from any market fluctuations. You don't want it in the stock market.
Right.
The market goes up and down. I can't tell you, David can't tell you what direction it's going to go tomorrow in the next 3 years, 5 years. So you want to take that money out, and you might want to draw it down slowly now or take a lump sum out all at once and put that in, say, CDs or a money market account, and also the very short term in your checking account, in your savings account, so that you can pay your bills. But you want to protect that money, and every year you're going to take out however much more that you're going to need to live on for the next 5 years. So after you've spent a year's worth, you'll be taking another year's worth of expenses out of there. All this time, you're leaving all that other money in the market to grow for the long term.
And do I take it out according to the percentages that it's invested? If I have a third of it in one fund and a sixth of it in another fund, do I try to keep those funds balanced the way they are at this point?
Well, when you leave the workforce, that's a life change that also requires an asset allocation change. You also want to look at the performance of those funds over the long term and the fees you're paying. I'm afraid I don't have the simple answer here. You know, it might be worth it to go to a financial advisor and get a second opinion, get a third opinion to figure out the best way to start drawing down on your investments that you've made.
No doubt a personal finance, a financial planner or advisor who you are paying only on an hourly basis, not a percentage of anything, should be able to help you think about intelligently which one to sell first and in what proportions.
That sounds great. I really appreciate your sharing this with me, and I will talk to a financial advisor and get a little help.
I think that's a great idea, Joan, and I thank you for asking a question that we don't probably talk enough about on this show, because you've opened up a vehicle for us to discuss a subject of relevance to a lot of people. Thank you.
I'm glad to do that.
Best wishes.
Thank you.
And that's it for the Fool Phones this week. The Fool Phone line's always open for your financial questions and comments. The phone number 866-NPR-FOOL. Dana, thank you.
Thank you, David.